Welcome to Wyoming, my 307. I'm Carla Mowell, and call me weird, but I've always been fascinated by cemeteries. Maybe it's because I spent my early years in Aberdeen, Scotland, and there it's common for people to have picnics in cemeteries, right there, snacking amongst the headstones. Now, the two cemeteries I visit the most are in Grable and in Basin. Since Grable was already my very first dot on the map, today I introduce you to Basin, a quintessential small town. Basin is in the traditional lands of the Eastern Shoshone, Crow, and Cheyenne people. Bighorn County itself was formed in 1896. At that time, Basin and Otto were locked in a tight race for the county seat. At the last moment, Cody, which was in Bighorn County at the time, entered the race. And this ended up splitting the vote in the western part of the county between Cody and Otto, and by default, Basin became the county seat. The Bighorn County Courthouse, and therefore Basin, is historically significant because it's where one of the most famous court cases in Wyoming was litigated. On April 2, 1909, seven cowmen attacked a sheep camp near Spring Creek, just south of Tensleep, Wyoming. The raiders killed and literally roasted two men by burning their sheep wagon, and they also kidnapped two other men, killing their sheepdogs and dozens of sheep, thereby destroying thousands of dollars of personal property. Now, they were caught, and the case proceeded, and the jury convicted the defendants and sentenced them to prison. One of the prosecutors, Will Metz, summarized the meaning of the verdicts by saying, "It's the beginning of a new era, of a period where lawlessness in any form will be no more tolerated." Now, I hope to do a future episode on the Spring Creek raids, because that is a gross simplification of a very complex story of the deadliest sheep raid in Wyoming history. Now, today, Basin is known as the Lilac City. It has the beautiful, historic Bighorn County Courthouse, hosts the county fair, and houses the main county library. Basin is also part of the new Bighorn River Blue Way initiative. Once complete, the Blue Way will include almost 100 miles of amenities for paddlers. We're talking parking, on-ramps, bathrooms, and camping all along the way. Now, one of the best things about being on the water is how very quiet it is. Unlike hiking, you don't scare off the wildlife as you silently glide through the river's current. And along that 11-mile stretch from Basin to Grable, I have seen eagles, owls, deer, and of course, beavers. And one of these is today's Wyoming wildlife. But first, let's hear from today's guest, Jennifer Romanofsky. She's going to help us understand the history that we can learn from cemeteries.
I know that you've called cemeteries the great equalizer. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So we have to go back to how cemeteries were laid out. What's fascinating about cemeteries is you can tell a lot simply from the layout what the values or situation of the town was at the time. Probably the most common one currently right now that we're seeing is what we call memorial parks. It's kind of where death has essentially been removed. It disappeared, so to speak, because all of the markers are like grass markers. Like, unless you are walking in the field and you happen to glance down, you see the headstones that way, the markers. Whereas in your more traditional cemeteries, the headstones are upright, their visual death is present. And so it's been interesting because depending on which region of the country you're in, you can tell the values of a cemetery, again, by how it's laid out and also the symbols that are used. For instance, in the South, you're typically going to have more family cemeteries versus a community cemetery. That has to go in with the history of the plantation system, how a lot of towns were really the plantation. And then as that system kind of died away and we get more urban settings, the cemeteries start to reflect more of that urban setting. The mid-Englanders, mid-Atlantic states for so much, they have more what we call churchyards. The church was the focal point of some of the earliest colonies, and so their graveyards, cemeteries are more churchyards. So that's where that name comes into play. Once you move into the immigrant trails of the westward expansion, you get what I like to call, what is called boot hill cemeteries. These are very organic, very willy-nilly. There's no layout whatsoever. It was because towns were developing so quickly. And, you know, if you know your history of the West, you know, you've got your, you know, your hell on wheels, your border towns, your frontier towns, your Wild West towns, so to speak. And everyone was so focused on living and achieving the American dream that when you died, sometimes you were just literally buried with your boots on, like just on some random hill, if you were lucky. So hence the term boot hill cemetery.
Well, I've walked around kind of off trail in the Bighorns, and I've come across just like rock piles out in the forest. Is that possible that it's a lone grave?
I'm not familiar with any specific graves in the Bighorn Mountains outside of Soldiers Park. And ironically, the graves there are not actually soldiers. That's just kind of what they're called. But if you travel along remnants of the Oregon Trail, because the trail moved to every wagon train depending on grass and water and weather, you are going to find really random graves and headstones, so to speak. For instance, those would be examples. What Buffalo, particularly our Willow Grove Cemetery here, as well as some of the cemeteries that you showed me pictures of, are Fairmount cemeteries. These are planned. There's an orderly layout. There's orderly burial plots. You have specific sections for families. You have specific sections for military areas. And so that is probably the one that a lot of people are more used to, which is the Fairmount style. And then when you actually go to the Fairmount styles, you can really tell by the order of what was essential to them. Like, for instance, a lot of cemeteries, unfortunately, have children's sections. And it came strictly down to a business decision. You could fit more graves in a section that was dedicated specifically to children than having the children buried with their families. I'm not saying families were not given the option of having their children buried in their family plots, but if there was a need to put them in the children's section, they were encouraged to, because you could fit two children's graves over just one adult grave.
I've also wondered with children's graves, when I've seen headstones that just say baby and don't say the name or the year or whose baby it was, I wondered if that was a economic decision, like they were already made and you could just purchase one that said baby.
So sometimes headstones that just say baby on them, it may be the family did not have a name picked out for the baby, or the baby was born young enough that they didn't know the sex of the child, or most of the time it was miscarriages or stillborns. For instance, more back east than necessarily out here, you see baby out a lot because I think it was the tradition during the colonial era to not name a child until they survived at least 6 months, because infant mortality was so common during that time period before, you know, the introduction of antibiotics and germ theory and whatnot.
So what can we tell about someone's life by looking at their headstone?
Oh, there are so many that you can learn about. For instance, the type of material that a headstone is made of can tell you kind of the economic structure of that particular individual or of that family. You know, marble is more expensive than rock. If it's handmade, maybe the family decided to save costs by making their own headstone, or maybe they did it for sentimental reasons. Particularly out here in Wyoming, there are some headstones in Willow Grove that are made from rocks and all of that. Perhaps it came from the ranch that the family lived on. Perhaps it came from the original homestead. I mean, you don't know. That's some of the stories that I like to make up when I look at headstones.
Right. And I gave you a couple of photos. One was of two headstones that are made of wood. So I don't know if you still call them headstones, but the other one was made out of rock, like you said, like a bunch of kind of fist-sized rocks. And I think the homemade headstones are my favorites.
I am partial to earlier headstones. I'm not by any means discounting the more modern ones that you see with the very elaborate carving. But headstone techniques have come so far. I mean, you can diamond etch, you can sandblast, you can do extremely intricate headstones now that really show the value of a person. Like here in Willow Grove, we have a distinctive Basque population. And so there is a lot of motifs of Basque sheep wagons, a sheep herder with his sheep. And they're very intricate, very detailed. You can see the fur on the sheepdog.
One of the new trends I've noticed in headstones is metal ones, like a sheet of metal that's been cut out with like natural motifs. So like a mountain skyline type thing or deer.
Yes. That is very common. We get a lot of that out here. So because of the current techniques for headstones, the symbols on a person's headstone, like modern headstones, are a more literal than headstone symbols from the past. And it comes back to when headstones had to be chiseled by hand, they were very simple, and it was more about the symbolism attached to the headstones rather than the literal interpretation of the symbols. For instance, headstone iconography really changed during the Victorian era when Queen Victoria made it essentially cool to mourn for your loved ones. That's where the idea of rest in peace developed, because in the colonial era, a lot of the symbols were like, death is finite, you've got your skulls, you've got your hourglasses, you've got your scythe symbols, you've got your skulls. It was, and that belief is death is permanent, death is unavoidable, you know, death is finite. And then Queen Victoria introduced symbols that talked more about life after death. You see more of your angels appearing, your floating hands, clouds, people sleeping, because it's the idea of your life has not ended, it's just moved to a different plane. Whichever religion you think of, life continues after death. So it's more of a gentle approach to death.
Right. Well, you're talking about a lot of symbols that are sounding very familiar to me, because I also sent you a document that has photos with some of those symbols that you talk about. Could we look at some of the photos that I took at a local or a couple of local cemeteries, and you just kind of talk us through some of those?
Of course. Let's start with the Graybull Cemetery that you sent me pictures of.
I'm really interested because I think I know it's like a Woodman of the World style, the one that's a cross that looks like it's made of wood, but it's actually made of stone.
Yes. So this is a fraternal organization, and I love their headstone because it's so elaborate and you can tell the detail, but it's all made from stone. But it's a thick tree trunk with two branches coming out maybe about 4 or 5 inches. So there's no leaves. It's just kind of a stump with two stumps coming out of the side in the shape of a cross. Sometimes it has a scroll hanging from the headstone, sometimes it doesn't. But the Woodmen of the World was originally a fraternal organization that provided financial services such as insurance, and it encourages relationships, stewardship, community, accountability. The reason they chose a tree as their symbol for their headstone was it came down to a speech that someone made during the Great Awakening, the revival, all of like the civic movements that started from like about the 1850s to the 1900s. That's when you get a lot of the founding of some of the more contemporary fraternal organizations that we're familiar with, the Lions, the Shriners, and the speech introduced the idea that you can clear away the problems of financial insecurity just like pioneer woodsmen cleared away the forest to provide for their families. So it's playing on this motif of pioneers, but using clear cutting and wood to show that to be stable as a pioneer or a homesteader, you had to clear away trees. And that was the whole point of the Woodmen of the World organization, was to provide financial stability, such as insurance and whatnot.
I was going to ask about just the little notch at the top, because it's not completely flat like two logs. You can actually see like a fake notch in the wood. And I was wondering if that was somehow symbolic.
Not that I have come across anything in my research, but all the headstones pretty much look the same. And they used that headstone until the 1920s when it became too costly.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
And that's when they moved to just a normal headstone with the WOW emblem on the headstone.
So tell us what other ones caught your eye.
Well, if we're going to continue the trend of fraternal organizations, let's talk about Henry L. Meade's headstone. He's got, of course, the one that probably everyone recognizes the most, which is the Freemason compass. And the Freemasons go back so far. It's like one of the most mysterious and yet most recorded organizations out there. A lot of our founding fathers were Freemasons. There is a belief that the Freemasons originally formed from stonemason guilds. So that's why the Carpenter Square and the Carpenter Compass is part of the emblem of the Freemasons. Their organization was designed that moral correctness was kind of the foundation of their organization. And the compass and the square not only reflected maybe the history of them descending from stonemason guilds, but also about how the compass and the square set boundaries not only in a stonemason graph, but also boundaries in your life. Boundaries for community rules that you follow, family rules, personal rules, things that guide you to be an upstanding citizen in your life.
I thought the dates were interesting on this one, because there's just years, and they're, the way they're set is at an angle. So 1864 to 1937. Really, the reason I took a photo of this particular headstone is because I vaguely remember that in Grable there was a Meade Hotel, so I think he was a hotel owner, and I just wanted to connect those dots. But what do you think about those dates being like at an angle like that over the double-headed, some kind of bird?
The double-headed eagle? You know, it's not common. It could simply just be how the stonemason carved the dates into it. It is unusual, in fact, that the birth date is not included as well as the death date. It could be, you really don't know whether he designed his headstone or the family designed his headstone. That's sometimes where you have your own personal interpretation and you're not quite sure it's right.
What did you say the symbol was at the bottom right?
So that is the Shriner emblem. That one's fascinating because the Shriners still exist today. Their main foundations for the Shriners is to engage in personal growth, and they are also dedicated to providing expert medical care with no financial burden for children and families. It's hard enough having a loved one desperately ill. If they can help by taking away some of the financial burden, the family can focus on the health and the well-being of the child. What is fascinating is no one actually knows, a lot of people don't know, the original name of the Shriners. The official name of the Shriners is the Ancient Arabic Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. So once you know the official name of the Shriners, the emblem motifs makes a lot more sense. Their emblem is a sphinx head with two claws extending from the sides that enclose a star and a scimitar that is placed above the head. Obviously, the sphinx represents the name, you know, the Arabic, the Middle East area. The star represents all of the children that they helped. The scimitar personifies the backbones of the fraternity. So it's playing on that motif of Arabia, as well as the fact that they are backing up their organization not obviously in military battle, but in a financial battle and a health battle for these kids. And the two claws represents the two branches of the Shriners. One is the Shriners organization, and the other one is the hospitals that the Shriners establish, support, and maintain for the health of the children and the families.
And on the double-headed eagle, now that I zoomed up to look at the Shriners, I just noticed that on top, kind of between the two heads just above, is the number 32.
So, yeah, unfortunately, I don't know what the 32 means. I do know there are two ideas of where the double-headed eagle means and what it represents. So the first idea for the double-headed eagle is that it's the symbol for the ancient and accepted Scottish rite of Freemasonry. Perhaps Mead is a Scottish name, and perhaps he is a member of that fraternal organization. The other meaning is it's a symbol of empires. The double-headed eagle was used in a lot of empires, such as, I believe, the Prussian Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, the German Empire. The double head represents the dual purposes of an emperor, the sovereignty, so to speak. One is the secular sovereignty of them being a head of state, and the other one is them being the head of the church. You took one of my favorite pictures. If you go to the Odessa Cemetery, Lena Nelson. Oh, I just love hers. She's just filled with symbols that goes back to kind of the Victorian era. So on her headstone, she was born in 1882 and died in 1912. And carved in kind of a minor relief is columns with this beautiful arch with these ornate gates opening up and what looks to be a diamond-shaped floor. And through the gates, you see this floating anchor and stylized clouds with words in Latin. And then above that, her headstone is kind of rectangular shaped with a slanted top that has an open book that has a piece of cloth draped over it. I mean, the symbolism of this is so Victorian and just fabulous.
Well, and just a minor correction, I think I can read what it says. And it's in English. It's peace, perfect peace.
Oh, that would make sense. I thought it was in Latin. I couldn't see it from the glare.
Yeah, because I was there, so I took notes, and I kind of darkened it a little bit on the photo, so I can see that it says peace, perfect peace. And then, of course, on the bottom, it says, we will meet again, which is so sweet and beautiful.
Again.
And I hadn't noticed that she also doesn't have a actual calendar date, just a year date, 1882 to 1912.
And it could just be common for that time period. But the symbolism, I mean, you've got pastoral symbols, you've got religious symbols, you've got architectural details. I mean, and they all sort of reflect the same thing. And this is where I have the most fun, because you can tell that this is an older headstone. You know, it was hand-carved, and so you have to understand the symbolism of the symbols versus the literal interpretation of the symbols.
Like, so what is the book and the, what is the book and then the draped cloth?
Yes.
I don't know.
So the open book can represent wisdom and faith. It goes back to the idea of life is an open book. I think Shakespeare said that. You have a beginning, you have a middle, and you have an end. So a book is a very common motif in kind of the Victorian era. It could mean your family history. I don't know if she's buried in a family plot or if she was the matriarch of a family, but that could be an interpretation. The fact that it's an open book may convey the sense that her life has not ended, even though she's died, but she has gone up into heaven and her life continues just on a different plane. Sometimes when the book is closed, that interpretation means that that person's life history is complete. They have reached the final chapter and their life book is closed. Now the drape is continuing that interpretation of the book. And again, I think this is Shakespeare. Life is a stage, right? And the fact that the book is half covered by the drape means that your life is ending, the play has ended, your book is closing, just like the end of a show.
And what about the anchor? I'm assuming she wasn't a sailor.
No, so this goes back to our Christian symbols. That is what the floating anchor and the clouds mean. So the anchor, this kind of goes back to your virtues. Unfortunately for Willow Grove Cemetery, I haven't come across any female statuary that personifies any of the virtues. Some more established cemeteries back east or towns that have a little bit more wealth attached to them, Gilded Age barons and, you know, cotton industry and whatnot. There are seven virtues, and you can usually tell the virtues based on what they're holding. A virtue that held an anchor meant love, faith, and hope. And it's religious connotation because a lot of people traveled overseas in ships for religious freedom, or they traveled as missionaries to spread the gospel. So that's why a ship's anchor is very much a religious symbol, even though it's not necessarily, it's more known as being a naval symbol.
And I love how it says Lena Nelson, period, and then her death year, period. Like, it's so final, you know?
It's floating through these open gates. It again reiterates the religious connotation that her religious faith, her religious soul is continuing the journey up into the clouds of heaven. She's no longer weighted by your flesh and blood, but your soul, the anchor of your religious faith, is floating up into heaven on your last journey. Hence the gates, the arches. Arches are used to symbolize the entrance into a home, the entrance into a building, the entrance into an arena. That is why arches are very prevalent with religion as well.
Well, we can look at more.
Yes, you have a wonderful children's headstone, also from the Odessa Cemetery. It's the children of B.F. and Alice Sharon. They have a baby boy that died at birth, and then George H. that died a year and a half years old, if I do my math correctly. Children's graves are fascinating because it was really during the Victorian era, this time period in the early 1900s, even into now, that children got a lot of their own headstones. The infant mortality is not as bad, so every birth was treasured and is even acknowledged after death, whereas I'm sure it was so painful for some of the earlier communities, colonies, and whatnot, that some children didn't get graves because it was just so common. Now, for this particular grave, you have the very shallow heart shape, again, saying that when you give birth, you feel like your heart has left your body. So hearts are very common in children's headstones. So are baby animals, like lambs, which can be seen on the top of this headstone. This is a pastoral symbol as well as a religious symbol. The idea that Jesus is the shepherd, it alludes to Psalms 23, the famous, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He will lead me through green pastures," and, you know, so on and so forth. Lambs, because they are so meek and they require so much care and protection, the lamb stands in as the guardian of children, how children have needs for care and protection that are taken care of through Jesus now that they're dead, but also by their parents at life. Some other animals that are common are doves, specifically birds. They also represent gentleness and peace. Doves with their wings are used to signify that the deceased soul has left the body and is rising to heaven, much like the dove was the symbol of the animal that brought back proof of life to Noah when he was in the ark. And how when Jesus was baptized in the water, the dove appeared. So the dove is also a very prevalent children's motif on headstones, but a dove specifically with a broken wing can also represent the fact that the body has been grounded to earth and it can no longer fly, so that the life, because they died so young, can no longer soar and grow like a dove.
When folks were purchasing these headstones or planning for these headstones, did they mix and match symbols, or do you see like this exact same headstone in another cemetery down the road or across the country? I guess I'm trying to ask, were they mass manufactured and you picked from a finished one and then just added your own words, or was every bit or a lot of it tailored to what the deceased's life was?
My personal belief is that there was a blueprint for headstones in terms of shapes and kinds, but to me personally, I feel that the family made each headstone personally to reflect the individual that died. I know that there are categories of headstone symbols. We've covered some of them. They all kind of show up regularly in specific aspects of cemeteries. For instance, in Mormon headstones, you see a lot of pine cones. All of the seeds in the pine cones represent generations, your family, and family and genealogy is very important in the Mormon faith. So you see pine cones a lot. But you also see flowers that showcase regularly across the board, regardless of age, sex, demographic, economic status. I think it's how it's placed and where it's placed and what kind of flower is used, again, I think comes down to the personal preferences of the individual who ordered the headstone. And that's where you need to do a little bit more research. I like to wander around cemeteries and just kind of, based on my experience, create a personal story about the headstone that I'm viewing. But if I did a little bit more research into the burial permits, the company that the headstone was ordered from, I may be able to fine-tune my story as to whether it was mass manufactured or individually ordered.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, doing some research, because I got pulled into a total rabbit hole after I went to the Grable Cemetery. One of the headstones in particular really stood out to me. Well, I mean, several of them did. One was Jack Kopman, who I sent you a picture and I'll post it on the show notes. That name Kopman is very well known on my side of the mountains because of Kopman's tomb. Mm-hmm. It's a prominent cliff on our side of the mountains. And I've always wondered why it was called Kopman's tomb. You know, did he die up there? And so I had done some research on that. And it turns out that he always said he wanted to be buried or have his ashes scattered there because he had big plans to fly off there. This was before the Wright brothers. He was also tinkering and trying to make a flying machine. And he mm-hmm. was going to fly off of there. But if it didn't work, he said it was going to be his tomb. So, long story short, it ends up being named after him, but his wishes were to be buried up there. Well, he died before his wife, and his wife chose to bury him next to her, in her future self, in the Grable Cemetery. So I got to see Kopman's actual tomb, or his actual headstone in Grable, and that was a treat to be able to see that. The other one was Behrouz and Claretta Basri. I mean, the name Behrouz Basri just stood out to me as not being a local. And so I came home and did some research and consulted Facebook. One of our local history Facebook groups, I posted a question like, was anyone around in 1970 something when this young couple died on the same day? And it was so amazing. Like, I literally crowdsourced the entire story, but for a couple of details that I got from the local paper and from some other online resources. But have you ever been sucked in to research on a headstone? And could you just tell us a little bit about that experience?
Oh, yes. I have gone down so many rabbit holes. Here at Willow Grove Cemetery, we have what's called a Potter's field. This is a riff on what a lot of people are probably more familiar with, which is a pauper's field. Pauper's field, or the Potter's Field here at Willow Grove, has about 14 burials in it. The community legend was that it was where the Red Light District women were buried. And the Johnson County Historical Society, I think back in the 70s or 80s, got tired of that myth being perpetrated. And they said, we're going to go through the records and we're going to prove whether this is true or not. And they discovered that in actuality, not a single prostitute was buried among the 14 graves. They were able to prove through records, obituaries, and whatnot that essentially our Potter's Field is where Johnson County at that time buried essentially the people who did not have a family advocate. What I mean is they didn't know who to contact as to whether they wanted to be buried, whether they wanted to be transported to a different cemetery somewhere else. A lot of the graves in our particular Potter's Field are young cowboys who died in freak accidents. One of them was struck by lightning, I believe. Another one drowned in a sudden flash flood. There was an older cowboy who died from heart failure. We have one, unfortunately, I mean, it's not politically correct, that says Archie the Chinaman, because that's the only information they knew about him, is that he was Chinese and his name was Archie. We have a baby Harmon there. Perhaps the family didn't settle in the town. You know, we don't know the story of the baby. We just know that it was a stillbirth. The baby was unnamed and it was buried in Potter's Field. We have one female buried there. And this is where my spiral continued. On a side note, the Jim Gatcher Memorial Museum does this program in the summer that we call the Echoes of the Past Cemetery Tours. And this is where we have volunteers doing first-person oral histories. They portray someone who's either buried at Willow Grove Cemetery. They portray someone who's got a connection to the community, but, you know, is buried elsewhere. Or they portray an archetype, like an anonymous Basque sheep herder or an anonymous miner and whatnot. Well, someone had picked the lone female at Potter's Field. Her name is Gertrude Gagnon. And she did all of this. She did what she could with the research that she had. She had her script prepared, and then I was going through the burial permits 3 or 4 days ahead of her first performance and found her original, I think it's 1893 burial permit from the city of Buffalo. And that's when we discovered that not only did she die young at the age of 23, she died from an accidental overdose of barbiturates while her husband was serving a term at the Wyoming a penitentiary. And not only that, but she was African American. So yes, you do indeed spiral down these rabbit holes just based off of a unique headstone that you see.
And what is this? You mentioned a document that you can look up, a permit type document. How do you find those?
So each cemetery is different. Here in Buffalo, we have a cemetery district. They have some records available. When I was looking for the burial permits, you have the option of contacting the City of Buffalo. You can also contact the Wyoming Newspaper Project, which is digitized newspaper editions that are available for free to research from the Wyoming State Library, and you can find that online. I don't know what it's like in Grable or Odessa, but here in Buffalo, we have one funeral home. And what's fascinating about this funeral home is it's been the only funeral home here in Buffalo, essentially since Buffalo existed in 1878. So the same family has been running this funeral home. So you can get some records to the funeral home if, you know, they're not in copyright issues. Some of the earlier ones, like the Frontier ones, Pioneer, or the early days, you can search them because they're not confidential, if that makes sense. If you've got a library or historical society or a museum like ourselves, you can do some research through the obituaries and through family connections that are developed depending on how involved the museum and the library is in their local history. I mean, they should be involved with their local history, but it also depends on their mission.
Well, I also found a website called Find a Grave, I think. I'll put it in the show notes.
And that's a good one, too. That's a crowdsourcing Find a Grave database. It's kind of like a Wikipedia for graves. Anyone can create an account and upload graves. And this is fascinating, especially for people doing genealogy research, because you may discover on your computer in Wyoming that you have family members that you never knew of who originated in, you know, Illinois. You don't want to drive all the way to Illinois just to go see your family's headstone. So you can go to Find a Grave, look up the cemetery, see if the picture has been posted of the headstone, or you can contact someone through the Find a Grave website or through, you know, their genealogy society or their historical society and ask someone to go take a picture for you. And most of the time, people are happy to help with genealogy research.
Yeah, that's what I did. I looked on Find a Grave and did get a link to an obituary. So that was very helpful. Are there any other resources you would like to share with us?
Patience, because you are going to realize that what you want to discover about an individual is not always going to be available. We run into this all the time in the museum field, where if we could just find that one document to prove a theory, but you can't find that document because it's been lost, because people didn't think it was important. But if you just want to focus on the symbolism of the headstones and not the individuals, there are so many resources out there. There's websites, there's books about, you know, how to read a headstone. I really like the Images of America series that Arcadia Publishing does. Everyone's probably seen those books before. They're usually always at a local bookstore. They're the lovely, thin history books that are filled with historic photographs and captions, and it's a really great way to introduce the town to your community, but you don't want to read like a really dense history book. There are some larger cemeteries that have actually done an Images of America book on headstones and the history. So those are some excellent books to read about the individuals and the cemeteries.
Well, thank you so much. This is all great information, and I'm definitely going to post it on the website. I have a few closing questions for you that I ask all of my guests, and one of them is, what is something that people driving through Wyoming may not realize?
I think, especially for someone who is not a Wyoming native, how much history there's here. You stop at the National Historic Trails Interpretive Center in Casper, and you discover, you know, all of the trails that you studied as a kid, the Oregon Trail game that you played on a kid, if, you know, had the fortune of being in that age demographic where you could play the Oregon Trail game, like the old school one, you know, where you died from dysentery and whatnot. That,
right.
The Mormon Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, the Bozeman Trail, the Oregon Trail, all of them went through Wyoming. The rich Native American history here, the proximity to all of the Indian War battles that you're familiar with, the influence even today of Native culture in some of our frontier towns. I'm thankful that the Longmire show and the Yellowstone show has really kind of put the West back on the map about its history. And, you know, we're not just cowboy culture, but we have, you know, homesteading history. We have military history out here that people aren't aware of. Wounded Knee, the proximity to Wounded Knee, the proximity to Little Bighorn, the proximity to, you know, some of the bigger battles. I always tell people all the time when they tour our museum here in Buffalo, people didn't realize that until Custer made some very poor decisions at Little Bighorn in 1876. The bloodiest battle during the 40 years of the Indian Wars, well, at that time, the 20 or 30 years of the Indian Wars, is just outside Buffalo's door, the Fetterman Fight, 1866. Captain Fetterman and 80 men are killed by Native Americans. That is a 15-minute drive from Buffalo.
And what's the hardest thing for you about living in Wyoming?
I wouldn't say the hardest thing. I would say the adjustment period has been a kind of a reverse culture shock, but not in a bad way. I came from a very kind of metropolis area in lower Michigan, kind of the Metro Detroit area. And Detroit has always been, for its 300 years, a port city for immigrants. Coming to Wyoming in a more rural city like Buffalo, who has less than 5,000 people, kind of the understanding that the multicultural aspect that I grew up with is not quite as prevalent out here. Some of our largest immigrant groups in Buffalo are the Basque, and they're European. Of course, we've got a Native background with Wind River Reservation, but the Middle Easterns, the African Americans, the Polish, German, you don't quite readily see the impact they have had in this area until you do the research.
Yeah, it's there. We just need to...
Yes, it's there, but you just have to dig deeper, which is what I love about my job in Wyoming, is digging further down and discovering that hidden history of Wyoming and the significant impact that these immigrants had, even if they didn't necessarily stay. I think that's the main thing that people don't understand about Wyoming. You know, back east of the Mississippi, families didn't really move around. They stayed for generations in maybe the same village or region or even state. And it wasn't until, you know, we started having access to the West with our land treaties that people started migrating. I think the West is a story of migration. And that's why there's so much hidden history still to discover, which again is why it's so fascinating to tour cemeteries, because sometimes it's not until you visit a cemetery that you'll discover maybe an Irish section or the Basque section or, you know, an African American section or maybe a Chinese section because you happen to live in an area where the transatlantic railroad came through and a lot of the Chinese and worked on it. So that's where I think cemeteries is kind of the great equalizer. Your history is not skewed towards one demographic or one economic status or, you know, one race, because it's all unveiled in the cemetery.
And what do you love about Wyoming?
I like the dichotomy of people being welcoming, but also kind of insular. They're slow to change, I will admit that, and they're passionate about their beliefs, but also the fact that they're welcoming to the heritage. They're more welcoming of the history of an area. And quite frankly, I don't miss the really heavy winters from the Midwest.
You love our mild Wyoming winters.
The fact that we don't have large metropolis areas in Wyoming means that a lot of the focus is on your smaller towns, and each of them have their own story to say, and you can kind of see the necklace of history that they're all connected by.
It's so true. Well, thank you so, so much, Jennifer. Today's been very enlightening.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Jennifer Romanofsky of the wonderful Jim Gatchell Museum in Buffalo. After we talked, I did a little more research and found out even more information about some of the symbols that she discussed. For example, the meaning of the number 32 on Henry Meade's headstone. You can also read the fuller story behind Claretta and Behrouz Basri, whose headstone is in the Grable Cemetery, kind of. And you can find these details and more on the show notes. Well, now it's time for our segment on Wyoming wildlife. It's inspired by my magical encounter with an owl while I was visiting the Whaley Cemetery between Shell and Grable. It was pretty spooky visiting the cemetery on a cold winter day with only an owl for company. I couldn't 100% tell what kind of owl it was, because it turns out we have 12 species of owl here in Wyoming. I'll post a video of what I saw on Instagram, and if you listen closely, you can hear it hoot. Based on habitat ranges, it could have been a barn, long-eared, great gray or great horned owl. But the hoot, it makes me think it was a great horned owl. But I just can't be 100% certain, so please check it out on Instagram. Maybe you can help me. So if it is the great horned owl, it turns out to be one of the most common owls in the U.S. And as with most owls, they navigate almost soundlessly. Despite their name, they don't actually have horns. Those little things are just tufts of feathers called plumicorns, which sounds so fancy. Great horned owls can rotate their heads about 270 degrees, which means they can literally see behind their heads. And they can do this because they have 14 bones in their necks, compared to us with only 7. Even though they can't see in color, their eyes are still 35 times more sensitive than our eyes. And they also have amazing hearing, with the ability to hear sounds as far away as 10 miles. 10 miles! Now, taken together, their silent flight, exceptional hearing, and amazing vision, it makes them very fierce predators. Well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed learning how to read a cemetery and a little more about basin and great horned owls. If you're interested in more, check out the show notes at wyomingmy307.blogspot.com and follow wyomingmy307 on Instagram and Facebook. If you want advance notice plus some behind-the-scenes information, please sign up for my email updates on my show notes page or email me at wyomingmy307@gmail.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please rate the podcast and share it with your Wyoming-loving friends and family. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Ooh.